This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. The University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences and the Duke University Marine Lab are holding a workshop to bring K-12 teachers together with over 40 local scientists. The second annual Siren event will be held February 20th. The program seeks to inspire students to learn about our coast by placing scientists into the classroom of local schools. Last June, I visited Tiller School in Beaufort, where a class of third grade students were learning about coastal habitats, food web dynamics, and the different types of marine life found along the North Carolina coast. Graduate students from the Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City offered a unique, hands-on lesson about our coastal ecology. Tiller School third grader Jack McMahon.
I was an oyster drill. An oyster drill is a kind of animal that finds an oyster shell and it drills through oyster shells to eat the meat.
The new one-of-a-kind program SIREN, an acronym for the Scientific Research and Education Network, is aimed at building a relationship between coastal scientists and local teachers. The idea, the brainchild of grad students Ethan Tierkoff and Justin Ridge.
Ethan and I both come from a background where we have parents who are teachers, and we know that teachers oftentimes are limited in both resources and time. And so we thought it was just a great idea to help them out by bringing everyone together into one place.
On April 25th, the first Siren networking event was held at the North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores. Ridge says about 60 teachers from across eastern North Carolina, the Triad, and even Virginia participated.
And so we like bring the teachers and the scientists into the same room and get them talking. And the scientists have prepared all these lesson plans and activities, and they gave them to the teachers. And so it helps the teachers with the resources. But then, I mean, as scientists, we need to get our science out into the community.
The April workshop provided scientists an opportunity to share free, grade-oriented resources on lessons about the ocean, including how pollutants are spread by ocean currents and how barrier islands respond to sea level rise. Tiller School's technology teacher Kelly Riley was at the event.
We had an opportunity to go around and actually experience many of the activities ourselves, ask questions. They gave us handouts and things to bring back, and of course their contact information.
Riley is responsible for taking the SIREN program to Tiller School. Since that workshop, four groups of scientists have visited the school to engage students about the coastal environment. She says the lessons help reinforce what's being taught in the classroom.
We have a tremendous amount of information to cover. And so if we have this network and these connections available to us, we have the opportunity to go to the experts. So the teachers are learning, but then the first-hand information coming to our students is invaluable.
Grad students Michelle Broder and Sarah Coleman presented a SIREN lesson on the ocean's food web to a third grade class at Tiller School.
Okay, so I think there's somebody over here who might eat these oysters who have escaped so far.
Both scientists designed the ecology lesson to speak to the imagination of youngsters about the complexities of coastal habitats.
So we're going to start with the green, okay, the primary producers. So who wants to be phytoplankton? You too.
After reading a description of their animal on an index card.
I eat lots of things, including worms, barnacles, blue crabs, and shellfish.
The students sit next to their animal food source. A piece of yarn connects the two together, forming a chain. Then, the chain is connected to other food chains, forming a food web. Third grader Charlotte Bickley's role as a periwinkle snail helped her understand how the food web works.
Once you think of a food web, you think like a spider web and stuff like that. The yarn kind of represents a spider web, but it keeps going down and down and down, like the top food chain and the bottom of the food chain.
Right. So it's like a bunch of food chains connected all together.
Yeah.
The activity also introduced student Chase Lewis to new ocean life he's never heard of before.
I can't remember it, really. It was something like a pod. It's a small creature that's kind of like a shrimp, except way tinier.
Grad students Michelle Broder and Sarah Coleman also taught about the different habitats that are found off the coast.
Everybody's going to be eating on everybody else, right? So what do we do sometimes if we're scared, if we want to feel safe? What do we do?
Go into defense mode.
Defense mode? That's right. I heard it over here.
Hide.
We want to hide. Right. So how do we hide from predators?
Go in your shell.
go in your shell. That's a good one. But what if you don't have a shell? What if you're a fish? Yeah.
After another activity, the third grade class had to prepare to dismiss for the day. Sarah Coleman explained to me the reason she wanted to be involved in the Siren program.
You can kind of get separated and, you know, being in academia and reading papers and doing experiments, it's very, like, narrow-minded, I guess. But then you have to think about why are we actually doing this? And, like, we want to get the information out there. And this was good because they're kids, so they're easy to talk to, and they get interested. Plus, like, they live here on the coast, so they are interested in how things work, and they want to, you know, learn more about, like, what's around them.
The school year is over now, but Tiller School's technology teacher Kelly Riley hopes to bring in even more coastal scientists and graduate students next year.
I've never had a student tell me that they loved the graph on page 79 of their textbook in all my 16 years. But I have had students come back and tell me, whether it's years later or in that same school year, oh, Miss Kelly, I loved this activity. Or do you remember when we did this? Or it's those hands-on opportunities that just make a difference with our students.
The Siren program is sponsored by the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences, North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores, Centers for Ocean Sciences Education Excellence Southeast, and North Carolina Sea Grant. The lesson plans and other resources are available to teachers for free. The second annual Siren event will be held on February 20th. If you'd like more information, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's raining the morning I'm recording this, like it's rained many days over this winter, and it reminds me how wet my yard is and poorly drained. And that, along with the fact that I looked at a piece of real estate this week, helped me realize that I have a wonderful tool to share with you that you might not be aware of. But let me back up for a minute. I did look at a piece of real estate this week, a tiny building lot in another town, and we really liked it. Luckily for us, it poured down rain the next night. I mean, a real gully washer. And when we went and looked at the site the next day, it was flooded. Which, you know, maybe you can adjust the way your lot drains, the direction in which the water flows, things like that. But it wasn't just this lot that was flooded. It was the entire street. Every yard was underwater, as was the road. And that reminded me, I had actually made the mistake of finding a piece of land that I thought I liked without checking what the soil was underneath. Now, we tend to think about soil as where we grow our plants. But you know what? It's also where our house might sit or where our driveway might be placed. And if you do those things on the wrong soil, well, you can have a real mess. But luckily, there is a wonderful resource that you can check to help avoid that mistake. This resource is the soils maps for every county. You can go to your local extension office and see if they have one of the old soils map books there. You find the spot you're looking for. Follow the codes back into the charts and determine exactly what soil type you have there. When I looked back at the soil type for this particular lot, well, it was identified as a soil that was, and I'll put this in quotes, very poorly drained. And not only that, the water table was 0 to 12 inches from the surface. Now that's scary. Imagine if you bought a lot and found that out after the fact. I can't believe I didn't look at it first. And you know why I can't believe it? Because I don't even need to go look at the soil book to find out what's going on any particular piece of land. All of that information has now been put on the web, and you can find it at, well, it's called Soil Web. But even better, there's an app called Soil Web. And when you have it on your phone and engaged with your GPS, you can simply stand on a piece of property, open the app, and the soil will be identified along with all its identifying characteristics. So whether you're looking for a place to put a garden or plant a big tree, or a place to put a house in a driveway, Knowing what soil is underneath, well, it makes a big difference. And I hope these tools will come in handy for you. And I'll talk with you next week in the Garden Journal.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Handscapes Gallery, a fine arts and crafts gallery located on the Beaufort waterfront, featuring jewelry, pottery, glass, and much more, with an emphasis on North Carolina craftsmen. Online at handscapesgallery.com.
Been having a little bit of a bad week?
And he is passing you off to a giant squid. You are part of some sort of food chain, my gosh.
Maybe you're feeling a little blue.
General sense of malaise, kind of.
How come you never mentioned this to me?
Wasn't sure how to pronounce it.
Well, we've got just the thing for you.
Made from whole wheat that gives shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done.
Join us this weekend, won't you?
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evenings at 6 on PRE Public Radio East.
The North Carolina Symphony, under the direction of resident conductor William Henry Curry, will perform one of the most powerful pieces of music ever written. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. The performance takes place February 4th from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Riverfront Convention Center. Public Radio East's Mac McKee spoke with Maestro Curry this week about what audience members can expect.
Maestro, thank you so much for joining us for Down East Journal today.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
What pieces and composers will you be spotlighting during this performance?
We'll be doing three composers, beginning with a piece by Gluck, very famous operatic conductor of the mid-18th century. This is his tricentennial, so we're celebrating that birthday. And then we're doing by Haydn, his Sinfonia Concertante, which is quite a mouthful. And what it is it's a combination, as the title implies, combination symphony and concerto, but it's a concerto for four instruments and orchestra as opposed to one instrument. And then we're doing perhaps the most famous symphony ever written, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Maestro, what makes Beethoven's Fifth Symphony easily one of the most recognized pieces of classical music, even by just casual classical music listeners?
It's been popular from its debut, and during World War II, for the Allies, it had a special meaning because if you took the very first four notes and put them into Morse code, it stood for victory. Three dots and a dash.
Oh, well. Now, as far as Haydn is concerned, I understand that he had quite an influence on Mozart's early work as well, too.
Very much. They were friends. In fact, one of the most endearing sentiments a composer ever said to anyone was Haydn said to Mozart's father, "Your son is the greatest composer I know of."
That's quite a compliment.
Yes, indeed.
Now, as far as Christoph Willibald Gluck is concerned, it seems like his inspiration for the Dance of the Furies and the Dance of the Blessed Spirits comes from Greek mythology, from the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, a poet-musician who lost his wife to Hades and he's trying to free her. Maestro, it seems like there are a lot of classic pieces, poetry, literature, and music that are based on, have a mythology-type base to them.
Yes, and I think that's because back in the 17th through the 19th centuries, the Greek mythology was something that was taught in the high schools and particularly the universities. Nowadays, it's not considered to be something that you have to know to be an educated citizen. But the Orpheus myth was of course, highly aligned with music because Orpheus tames these beasts with the spirit of music, singing, and playing on his lyre.
Maestro, which is your favorite of these three pieces that you're going to be performing?
Well, to be honest with you, whatever I'm conducting at that moment, I'm giving my full attention to. Now, if you really want me to answer even more honestly, the Beethoven is, to me, a sacred work. You have to know a little bit about the background of this work, I think, to really understand the triumph of it. You know, of course, that he was losing his hearing and was suicidal and worked through his despair in his Third Symphony, which he subtitled Heroic, and it truly was an act of heroism that brought him out of the trough of despair and led him to compose even more brilliantly. And you know what Nietzsche says, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. So the Beethoven in the Fifth Symphony is a quite ferocious beast. In fact, he said about the opening of the movement, I am going to seize fate by the throat. He decided he wasn't going to submit to destiny. He was going to control his fate. So it's an extremely dynamic, aggressive, in-your-face piece that has great appeal to all generations.
Well, Maestro, as always, thank you so much for giving us some time here at Public Radio East during your busy schedule.
Well, you're very kind, Mac, and I'm very grateful that we have such a great fan base in New Bern. It's a great place to play, and I'm greatly looking forward to it. Thank you.
The North Carolina Symphony, under the direction of resident conductor William Henry Curry, will perform Beethoven's Fifth Symphony February 4th from 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Riverfront Convention Center in downtown New Bern. If you'd like more information, visit publicradioeast.org. The North Carolina Symphony stop in New Bern is just one of many the full-time professional orchestra makes as it tours the state this year for their 82nd season. In 2009, the North Carolina Symphony released its first ever internationally available CD, which featured four works by American composers that were all receiving their first recording. George Olson spoke with the symphony's music director, Grant Llewellyn, shortly after the CD's release and has this, which originally aired in May 2009.
American Spectrum presents four works by American composers, three receiving their world premiere recording, in this first international release by the North Carolina Symphony. Interpreting these American works falls on the shoulders of the symphony's music director, Grant Llewellyn, who, musically speaking, is about as Americanized as a Welshman might be.
I've been immersed in the music of this country all my life, very directly from my days at the Tanglewood Music Center when I was working with Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copland and meeting all these great American composers of my generation. And so when I then ventured back to Europe, I would often be requested and required to program American repertoire. So I've always, through my professional career, had a pretty close connection to the music of this country.
His time at Tanglewood came in 1985 after winning a conducting fellowship there before returning to Europe for various posts, including with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. He's been music director for the North Carolina Symphony since 2004, and now, through the American Spectrum CD, seeks to offer a calling card of sorts to his native continent. Toward that end, he enlisted the help of Branford Marsalis, the Grammy-winning jazz saxophonist, faculty member at North Carolina Central University, and North Carolina Symphony board member.
He is absolutely scrupulous about his musical preparation. And, you know, I spent time with him out at his house, where he practices like a dog. I mean, he really puts in hours and hours every day practicing his scales and arpeggios and his changes. And, you know, he, in such a way that when he actually comes to the rehearsal room and the concert hall, he's so on top of the technical permutations that he makes it sound completely free. And I think that that is a real art, and it speaks to the, well, the professionalism of the player.
Marsalis is a featured player on two of the four works on American Spectrum. Among them is John Williams' Escapades for alto saxophone and orchestra. The work is adapted from Williams' score to the film Catch Me If You Can and features a lengthy solo by Marsalis that, to my ear at least, sounds as if the orchestra turns the page on the score to read and now Branford does his thing. As improvisatory as it sounds, it's not.
In fact, John Williams writes every single note that Bradford Marsalis plays in that, and that's again a fantastic example of the genius of John Williams. I mean, it sounds totally natural, I think, when Bradford plays it, but it's all notated, so he sort of captured that in manuscript.
Llewellyn was particularly enraptured with Escapades because of its source material, the soundtrack written for Catch Me If You Can, which he felt presented a side of John Williams most moviegoers don't see.
I think that this particular movie is quite unrepresentative, perhaps, of the typical blockbuster John Williams movie score, in that it's not, you know, sensationalist in any way. And I think he quite brilliantly has, you know, come up with a soundtrack which takes you into a particular world. And I don't think when watching it I was ever distracted by the music in a way that, you know, if you're watching a Star Wars or Close Encounters, at times you're sort of taken almost out of the screen by the impact of whatever the music is doing at that time. I don't think that's ever the case with Catch Me If You Can.
American Spectrum opens with a piece by Michael Dougherty entitled Sunset Strip, a musical imagining of the mile-and-a-half section of Sunset Boulevard that runs between Hollywood and Beverly Hills in California. It's part of a series of pieces by Dougherty inspired by American sights, though in Sunset Strip you might not hear America so much as you'll hear the American notion of a melting pot of cultures.
To my ear, what jumped out of it was the sort of the Latin flavor of the music, you know, the sort of Mexican mariachi inflection that obviously is part and parcel of that Californian culture as well. But yes, I mean, he's managed brilliantly to sort of synthesize in musical terms a sort of musical journey down the strip which takes in a whole spectrum of passing musical influences. But he somehow manages to conjure up an incredible atmosphere of the nocturnal life as well as the daily life. It's interesting that in the score he starts, I think, the first movement at 7 a.m. and then we have the nocturne, so it sort of takes you right through the day and right through the night, and I guess that's the way people kind of live out there.
The piece on American Spectrum that puts the North Carolina Symphony most through its paces is Christopher Rouse's Friandise, a work that Llewellyn describes as a tour de force for orchestra. It was written in 2005 for the New York City Ballet, and in that respect is a comfortable fit for the symphony. Llewellyn says the symphony has done a number of ballet suites, particularly those by Jean-Philippe Rameau in their concert performances. But while Llewellyn says Friandise is inspired by the idea of a French ballet suite, a French ballet suite it is not.
He stretches the French ballet forms in a way that anybody who's versed in Baroque dance would probably be completely horrified. But he's not trying to recreate a Baroque ballet suite here. He's trying to sort of take it out of its context and bring it into the 21st century and provide a vehicle that's going to challenge a major ballet company. But I think, as so much great ballet music does, it works purely and simply as music in its own right.
It's somewhat funny that in discussing a disc entitled American Spectrum, our conversation turns to French ballet and Mexican mariachi. There's nothing here that you might see as sweepingly American as, say, an Aaron Copland composition, who he worked with while at Tanglewood, but the fact that French ballet and Mexican mariachi can come up in a discussion of American music is what makes the music of American Spectrum so interesting to the North Carolina Symphony's music director.
And of course, the great thing about American music is that it's not any one thing. It's this wonderful sort of, dare I say, spectrum of styles and personalities and schools of thought. So it's an incredibly sort of eclectic world here that I've been only too happy to embrace.
Grant Llewellyn conducts the North Carolina Symphony on their first international CD release, American Spectrum, which is available on Beast Records. I'm George Olson.